In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about how it is in this country that we think about wildfires. Last year was a pretty bad year for fires in the country. Wildfires killed 17 people, destroyed 860 structures, and burned more than 7 million acres. And the thinking is, by some fire experts, that this year could be as bad as last year. Drought conditions do persist in a lot of the country, particularly in Florida and in the Pacific Northwest. Across the country, some 23,000 communities are now listed by the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, as being at risk of wildfire. More than 60 million acres of public land considered at severe fire risk. We're talking this morning with a guest who is generally considered to be perhaps the world's leading expert on fire and its role in human culture. He's an environmental writer and has written a good deal on this very subject. His name is Stephen Pine. He's professor of history at Arizona State University. He has been a MacArthur Foundation fellow. He won the LA Times 1995 Robert Kirsch Award for his contribution to American letters. He's the author of the 5-volume Cycle of Fire, which includes Fire in America, and also a book about Antarctica. So he's got both bases covered here, fire and ice. He also worked for 15 seasons as a forest firefighter on the Grand Canyon's North Rim. And the book that we'll be talking about this morning, it looks back to what has now historically been the worst year for wildfires in the history of this country. That year was 1910. And he's written a book that looks month by month at what happened during that year. The book is titled Year of the Fires, The Story of the Great Fires of 1910. It's published by Viking. And as we talk with Professor Pine, you certainly should feel free to pick up the telephone and give us a call. As we'd certainly be talking not just about 1910, but also about what our current fire policy is, which he says is misguided. So here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Pine, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
I was yesterday, partly in preparation, I was looking at a chart that showed the fire damage in this country year by year, and I'm scrolling down this list, and I get to 1910, and the figure comes up 3 million acres, and my initial reaction was, oh, no, of course, that can't be right. That has to be a mistake. But in fact, that's what we're talking about in that year, the acreage that burned. It was 3 million acres. It's just a staggering sort of thing to number to try to think about, that much territory being burned.
Well, actually, that number is inaccurate. The actual figure on the national forests alone was 5 million.
Oh, so it was actually even more.
The Northern Rockies.
Then I'm even more. The number is even more sort of mind-boggling.
Well, the numbers are even more staggering. Something like 7.9 billion are reckoned to have burned last year, but they're throwing in Alaska. They're counting all of the federal lands. They're counting everything that could be counted. In 1910, the only figures we have were for the national forests alone, and about 3 million acres burned in the Northern Rockies, which is more than burned last year. But who knows how much burned across the country. 40 or 50 million is not at all out of order.
Mm-hmm.
But the 1910 fires, the thing about them is that they were not simply big. They were big, but every year had lots of burning at that time. I mean, the U.S. at that time was not unlike Brazil in more recent times. People needed fire for agriculture. They burned everything. There were a lot of abusive fires, but there were lots of productive fires. The thing about the 1910 fires is that they were influential. They connected with the culture in various ways. And one of the means was institutional, that the U.S. Forest Service was on hand. A relatively new organization. It had had the national forests only since 1905. So the fires were seen by critics and friends both as a test on everything that the organization represented. Ideas of conservation, ideas of federal-state relations, was all caught up in a horrible personal fight between Gifford Pinchot, the chief forester, and Secretary of Interior Richard Ballinger, which ended in Pinchot being fired, Ballinger resigning, and the Taft administration eventually imploding. So there was a very strong political context, there was a cultural context, there was an institutional context. So the fires, which were large but were also lethal, 78 firefighters alone died at a minimum, connected. And they really implanted themselves into the culture.
And your argument, the argument you make, is that the way we think about fires, wildfires today, is rooted in the experience of this year, 1910, and that in addition, your argument is that we're taking a wrong-headed approach, but that approach still has to do with this experience going back now to the last century.
That's true. Essentially, all the debates about fire, what we should do, all the policy issues were rehearsed very publicly in 1910. And the nature of the fires, the trauma associated with the dead firefighters, the impact on what was a very young organization headed by very young men, managed to skew that debate. Instead of a debate, we had kind of a dialectic. And it went this way, that there were two opposing theories on how to protect forests from fire. And the one that the Forest Service argued for looked to forestry as an academic inspiration and source of knowledge, looked to Europe, especially the European colonial powers, Britain and France especially. The early foresters went through the British colonial system. They recognized the immense differences, but they also thought of it in those terms. And they argued for fire control. They argued that suppressing fire, fighting fires, preventing them, ultimately excluding fire from the landscape would be a positive good. This is the same era that, you know, wanted to control floods, wanted to control predators, and sort of other natural threats as they were perceived. And this is of a piece with that. And this was a very strong argument for a federal-based conservation program. The Forest Service assumed for itself the mantle of vanguard in conservation. But there was another approach. It was often called the Indian way, since those on the frontier at the time and in the rural West in particular saw the source, that they were adapting what the American Indian had done, and it was a program called light burning. And that was that on those forests that had an understory, usually grassy or light of some sort, understory, and these were mostly the forests that were of interest to people for logging or farming or grazing, you could regularly burn out that understory. You do it under benign conditions. They're not much to look at, the fires, but they would systematically clean out all of the fuel, the surface fuels, that would allow fire to get into the canopy and indeed create large fires. And this was very strongly argued, and there were lots of people promoting this all over the country. And this, in fact, went public. Sunset Magazine, in August of 1910, actually published a long article criticizing the Forest Service approach, even as the fires are blowing up around them. And saying that the whole thing is misguided, that this will lead to unhealthy forests, it will lead to congested forests, it will lead to fire traps, and in fact everything that's happened was forecast then. And the author even went so far as to argue that, sort of tongue-in-cheek, that the Army ought to be called out to do the burning so that you could protect private landowners from federal malfeasance. So this is clearly has sort of deep political roots as well. Now, it happens that Gifford Pinchot, the chief of the Forest Service, its charismatic founder, was a strong advocate of fire control, again, based on forestry and so forth. His family had actually endowed a school of forestry at Yale. It graduated its first crop in 1904. In 1905, the National Forests began hiring them. His rival in Interior, Richard Ballinger, however, was an advocate of light burning. So that political fight between the men gets translated as well into a choice, a polarization between fire lighting and fire fighting as the basis. Because of the nature of the fires, sort of the long march for the Forest Service, it impressed very deeply a whole generation that the argument ended up in favor of fire control. And in a sense, we are still living with that decision and legacy, even though for the last know, 25 or 30 years, for most of the federal agencies, there has been a recognition that in these fire-prone landscapes, like most of the West, fire of some sort is going to come in. It may be useful. It may be necessary. And we ought to try to put it back. Mm. What has happened, however, is that the process is not a simple, reversible one, that having taken fire out and caused all kinds of difficulties, we can't put fire back in and fire sort of returns it to what it was. Fire acts on whatever is there, and if you have messed up forests, you get messed up fires. And so the effort to sort of reinstate fire back in has been itself deeply compromised. And so the criticisms I would make are sort of more of a lament, perhaps, than a criticism of policy. I think the agencies know what they would like. The problem is overcoming this sort of polarized past and finding actual ways to make it happen on the ground.
Well, it sounds, I guess my understanding is that what you're arguing for is it's not an either-or kind of policy, but a policy that, in a sense, combines elements of both of these, that says that there certainly are points when we are going to have to fight fires, but on the other hand, we have to acknowledge the fire's place in nature and also the fact that forests do need preventive maintenance, and that there are also things that one could do to try to reduce the risk of fire, so that in a sense that you have to do some of both.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the time has come to end the question that we either have to fight them or light them. That's not working. Fire takes its character from its context, and the next stage is to think about that context. So think about the surroundings, the settings in which fire occurs. Now, there are a lot of places where fire historically existed. We may not want or need to put it back in. Those places where fire served a really distinctive biological role, it was an ecological process that this system needs. Those areas, we really have to put fire back, but they have changed. Most of these have changed so much over the last century that putting fire back does not create the kinds of fires that used to exist there. You're creating fires that have never existed there. And so they really can be very damaging fires. So exactly as you suggest, in those cases, we really need to create a setting for fire. It's not unlike reintroducing wolves or grizzly bears or something. You can't, you know, there used to be wolves, I'm sure, in southern Arizona where I am now, and there's an argument maybe we need to reintroduce them, but that's okay, but we're not going to reintroduce a pack of wolves into Arrowhead Shopping Mall, even though wolves 300 years ago might have been there or passed through. The setting's completely different. You're going to have to create a habitat for them to thrive, and you're going to have to pick those where it really matters. And that's how we need to think about fire.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Stephen Pine. He's professor of history at Arizona State University and has written a good deal about fire and its place in human history, a number of books, also a recent one that might interest some folks listening, A Short History of the Grand Canyon. It's titled How the Canyon Became Grand. And then this book we're talking about here this morning that looks at this one year, 1910, that was the worst for wildfire in American history. His book is titled Year of the Fires, The Story of the Great Fires of 1910. It's published by Viking. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. In the book, there's some history of, a little bit of a history of the Forest Service and their efforts at dealing with fires. And it seems to have been an overwhelming task, given how much territory they were talking about trying to monitor, the number of people they had to do that, the state of communications for doing that. And then once there was a fire, the tools that they had at hand to fight the fire, which pretty much was people and hand tools, it seems that it was a task that couldn't possibly have done it, even if they decided they wanted to do it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, this was an absurd proposition that they would somehow control fires. Fire guards might, on a national average, 470 to 600 70 square miles per fire guard. I mean, this is an absurd proposition if there are any kinds of fires. And in the western landscapes, at least in some years, you will have a lot of lightning, so you have to get to it. They recognized that it was a long haul. The means were primitive, very, very difficult to find the fires, difficult to get to them. You may have to, may take several days to reach them. One guy can't do it. He has to go back to town, hire a crew, bring them in. So more days have passed. The fire is larger. Any fire of any size, they would simply have to pull back to the nearest ridge top. They would cut a fire line. Think of it as a kind of trail. And then they would backfire from that. And so they were introducing lots of fire in the landscape as well. I mean, it was, in a sense, an absurd undertaking. But they felt that they were moving in the right direction, and that if they did more of that, they would eventually succeed. So they didn't think of this as protecting wilderness areas. They thought of developing the land, and they recognized that they could only succeed if they developed it. So in that way, the private and public sectors were both keen to develop. The question was whether it would be done with public money for public ends or private money for essentially commercial means. And after the great fires, I mean, you know, this—I mean, everybody in the field, actually on the scene, considered it a complete rout. That they were literally blown away and picking up the dead, and they went $1 million in debt. It was an enormous amount of money in 1910. The whole agency was rocked by this. But by the time the story gets back up to headquarters and the rest, it's interpreted as a gallant effort. As a sort of brave stand, and had they only had more money and more men, they could have won. And in fact, a man who will be chief forester in the 1930s, when the New Deal essentially gave them unlimited amounts of manpower and money, a few months after the 1910 fires, wrote an article in which he said that the lesson of the great fires was that they were wholly preventable, wholly preventable. That all it took was more trails, men, telephone lines, lookout towers, more will, and they could have prevented these fires, which is an astonishing declaration. But he and those of that generation will be in a position for the next 30 years to try to see that the great fires will never happen again, that they will declare an all-out war on them.
And certainly we have all of that and more today. We have modern communications, we have modern transportations, but we still have fires.
We still have fire because you have fire-prone landscapes. Now, not all of the country is prone to fire. What you need is a regular wet and dry cycle. It has to be wet enough to grow stuff and then dry enough to prepare it to burn. In many parts of the West, this occurs every year. Sometimes, or in other parts of the country, it occurs on a longer cycle, but that's finally what you need. And then you need some ignition source. And again, the West is prone early in the summer seasons, particularly towards dry lightning, lightning without much rain. And so you have all the ingredients for fire. So even if people remove themselves completely from the scene, there is going to be some kind of fire. And as a result of the way we've used these landscapes, and in particular how we've excluded fire for a very long time, they have grown up in really dense thickets. And I'm thinking of the lower elevation forests, the ponderosa pine, interior Doug fir, and communities like that. And they are now densely packed. They are primed for very intense crown fires of a sort that were not historically possible. Maybe little pockets would burn out, but primarily this was prone to very frequent surface burning. And the other condition that people are still struggling with, you know, one of the areas where I continue to argue is whether the fire is natural. Well, of course it's natural. In these conditions, fire is going to occur without people. But most of these landscapes, certainly in the lower elevation areas, were very frequently burned by people and deliberately burned, as well as accidentally burned. So there was an interaction. There has always been an interaction between human-caused fire and natural-caused fire in these landscapes, and together they shaped what we began to reserve as national forests and parks. So the argument that it's okay just to put fire back because it's natural, it seems to me to avoid the fundamental issues. The issue is what kind of fire you want and under what conditions. It also avoids the fact that many of these landscapes were, in fact, cultural creations, culturally created by American Indians regularly burning the place, not every acre, not every year, but creating, being a powerful shaper of that landscape mosaic, and we need to own up to that fact, which to my mind argues again for us to take the torch and start making those decisions.
It's interesting, you were writing the book about the conditions that came about to set up the Great Fires of 1910, and that it was a combination of people doing things and not doing things. On the one hand, fewer Indians deliberately setting fires, and on the other hand, movement of settlers into those areas. We put in rail lines. We carved up the territory various ways, so there was settlement, there was sources of ignition, and we also started setting aside these areas, creating the national parks, and that all of this really set up conditions for fire, and so perhaps we'd not be so surprised that once these things had been in place for a certain amount of time, we'd get to this point where we would have a stunning, spectacular. I think you write in the book about how things came together with tectonic force and laid down the conditions so we would have one spectacularly damaging year.
That's right. But we had a whole series of really awful fire years elsewhere in the country, particularly around the Lake States. Wisconsin, 1871, Michigan, 1881. Minnesota, 1890. There have been horrible years where hundreds of people had died, communities wiped out. So we had that as part of the background. But what was different about the 1910 fires was that they did not occur in a primarily settled area. In other words, these are areas that are part of a public domain. Settlement in the normal sense is excluded. Now, these past fires, people recognize them as horrible, and they certainly didn't want them. But they had created conditions which made them possible by wholesale land clearing, introducing railroads, which were notorious for throwing sparks every place, and by doing a lot of burning on their own to convert the land into farms. And under the right conditions, these would explode. But the theory was, and the expectation was, that this was sort of a temporary phenomenon, and that after the land was in fact domesticated into farms and pastures and towns, the fires would go away. And they did, because the conditions that fed them were gone. They were just a transitional feature. But what's happened in the West, in the public lands, is that we interrupt that process. So we may have the large fires, but we don't have a process of land conversion that will eliminate them. So it falls to the federal agents, in this case, to make those decisions. They either have to convert the land to something less combustible, or they are going to have to do the burning themselves. But in 1910, these were new ideas, and they really didn't have any precedent behind them. And so one can understand that it was difficult. There's a difficult learning process. And what made it more difficult was the suddenness and the trauma of the fires, really branding themselves onto a generation in ways that a normal learning, normal discussion and debate didn't occur. Instead of a constant give and take, there was slam. There was a huge, awful event, and people were determined to prevent it from happening again and were willing to take extreme measures. So that's what really skewed it, and that's part of what makes these fires not simply big but important.
A little bit past the midpoint here, I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Stephen Pine. He's professor of history at Arizona State University, and he's written a lot about fire and its place in human history. The book we're talking about here this morning, if you're interested, is titled Year of the Fires, The Story of the Great Fires of 1910, which was, as we have discussed, the worst year for wildfire in this country's history. Viking is the publisher. And one of the things that Professor Pine argues in the book is that that experience continues to shape the way that we think about how we should deal with wildfire in this country. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll free, 1-800-222-WILO. I'd mentioned the fact that you've written a lot on this subject and that you seem to be thought of as being the world's leading authority on fire history and the place of fire in human culture. How does one get that as a specialty? How did you become interested in this?
Well, it was an accident. I was hired a few days after I graduated from high school at Grand Canyon, and they had an opening on the fire crew at the North Rim, and I took it and then returned for a total of 15 summers. And meanwhile, I went through school, went all the way through, including graduate school, did absolutely nothing with fire in schooling. I mean, they were two completely different lives. And it was a wonderful way to live, actually. I really enjoyed it. But afterwards, by the time I got my doctorate, which I'd written on a geologist and explorer, I realized that I was really interested in fire as a subject, and I ought to try to apply the techniques and the scholarship I'd been trained to do in history and sort of cultural analysis as it was understood then to the subject of fire. And no one was really doing that. A few people, mostly in Australia, were looking. Anthropologists were interested in Aboriginal fire history and practices. A lot of people were reconstructing fire histories on particular sites by looking at tree rings and their scarring or sediments and the charcoal that's layered there and that kind of stuff, but nobody trying really to put together the whole picture about people interacting with the land through the medium of fire. And, you know, we have a species monopoly over this. So I regard it as a kind of unique ecological index of our agency, and saw it in those terms and began writing a series of books from different parts of the world, beginning with the U.S., exploring that question. And partly for reasons of sort of personal history, really no one else has seen fit to take on that task as well. So I have an open field, at least for a while.
One of the things that here I've seen in terms of recent stories on what we're doing to try to prepare for this season is that apparently there are people out in the West who are thinning overgrown forest, particularly around places where people live, where there's thought to be a risk, and that the Congress in this year's budget has increased the amount of money dedicated to that. It's $240 million, which apparently is tripled over what it was. That may not be a lot of money in terms of what the job is, though. What do you think about, is this at least part of the approach you think that we should be taking?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a very sensible approach. The devil is always is in the details. If you want to do the right thing by fire, you have to be very site-specific. And you have to ask, what is the requirement and the problem at this particular place? And it will vary. I mean, fire is a very nuanced phenomenon and very sensitive to its surroundings. What we have is that we go in about 20-year cycles of certain sort of dominant fire problems, and we're about halfway through the latest one, which the agencies call the wildland-urban interface. I prefer to just call it the intermix, but it has to do with mixing houses and sort of what the Australians would call bush, just sort of wildlands or overgrown land or recovered agricultural land or whatever. And that problem has been an accelerating one. It has really been the defining one for the agencies. And what we're seeing is another phase of that in which thinning, sort of housekeeping around these structures as a way of protecting them. That is to say, to reduce the ferocity of a fire coming in, reduce the amount of stuff available for it to feed on, and in that way provide some extra protection for houses. So we're seeing a sort of phase change in that thinking, and I would hope that the next phase would be to expand it from the concept of defensible space around houses to a kind of sustainable space or habitable space further back into the backcountry and begin creating a habitat where fire can begin to function as it used to. And that doesn't mean we turn it over to nature and let it run. It means we do it. Nature gave the task to us, and I'm reluctant to turn it back at this point. So I think that that's a very sensible approach. The money is being distributed, as I understand it, across all of the country, even areas which are not particularly vulnerable to fire. But that's, you know, this is how Congress works. And one certainly hopes that it will succeed. But again, it's a case of how it's done. I might also mention in this that lots of terms get attached to this. Thinning is one. Critics of various kinds would like to call it logging because that's a very loaded word. And indeed, the logging industry in some ways would like to call it logging. And it isn't. I see it as, if it's done right, it's a kind of woody weeding. It's a thinning out. These areas, there are areas, ponderosa pine forest in Arizona, for example, that say in 1860, 1870 had maybe 20 trees per acre, now have up to 2,000. So you're talking about a rather radical thinning. But you know, even so, we're hardly getting back to what it was. And the other thing is that in the thinning process or weeding, the big trees are not the problem. And that's where the logging term is being used rather deviously. The point is not to take out the big trees because they are not contributing really to the fire hazard. It's the small stuff. And anybody who's been around a campfire knows how this works. If you have a fire and you take a large green log and you dump it on the fire may in fact go out. The stuff's so moist it's going to absorb heat. But if you throw a handful of pine needles into the fire, then it will flare up. And it's the small stuff, which unfortunately does not have an easy commercial value, that needs to be removed. Hmm. So it gets difficult. I mean, it's understandable, but then, and there are technical solutions to this. The question is that people have lots of other agendas, and they want to use the fire problem to exploit those other agendas. So in many ways, instead of really solving the fire problem, all we're doing is talking politics and about other issues. And the fire is being used as a surrogate for those. And I'd like us to just knock that part off and just get serious about solving the fire problem.
Yeah. I suppose there might be some people that would make the argument that if you build your house in a forest, there is a risk of fire, and a fire comes along and burns your house down. Well, you should have known that. The same sort of argument that someone might make that says if you build your house in a floodplain and it floods, well, what were you thinking was going to happen?
That's precisely the case, although there are different levels of floodplains and different levels of fire. There are well-known fire corridors. They would be the equivalent of fire floodplains, and some of the best are in Southern California. The Santa Ana winds follow topography, and they're just going to go right down these channels, and every time they go through there, so if you build something in that, you're going to be slammed eventually. Other areas are much less likely to be hit on a routine basis, and I think it's defensible to build houses. It's just that you don't put a wooden roof on it, for heaven's sakes, and you do a modest amount of housekeeping. Part of the problem is that in the past, I see it as sort of recolonizing the rural landscape, but we're doing it by essentially urbanites. This is an ex-urban development. And instead of living off the land, if you were really in a rural economy, you'd be out there cutting and pruning and chopping and burning and grazing and doing all kinds of stuff to make it fire safe. But urbanites are living off a different economy. They have urban values, urban aesthetics, urban expectations, and they're allowing the stuff to grow up because it looks pretty, because they think it's quote natural, because it provides some shielding and privacy, lots of reasons. But what they are doing is creating fuels. So just as in the early settlement period where we created fuels by chopping things up and leaving them on the ground, now we're creating fuels by letting them grow up and not intervening. So, it's just, a part of it is just basic homeowner sense that you take care of your yard. Otherwise, if you're going to let it go wild and you're going to put bits of houses and cities against it, it's sort of a matter and antimatter collision, and we shouldn't be surprised that we get explosions. Mm. But it doesn't have to happen. There's always going to be a degree of hazard if you build a wooden house in an environment that's prone to free-burning fire. But you can certainly reduce that enormously by just a few simple measures.
We have a couple of callers. Let's bring them into the conversation. We'll start with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yeah, two questions, please. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the possibility that, or the prospect that invasive weeds are posing a major threat here in North America and elsewhere. And number two, and then I'll hang up, is that I've heard that there's a theory that the Aborigines in Australia may have radically changed the fauna in Australia by burning vast numbers of acres, and I guess that kind of evidence is showing up in other continents as well. So invasive weeds and how early man destroyed the ecology. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, good questions. The weeds problem are a major problem, and they're going to be a major difficulty in any effort at restoration. I don't care for the term restoration. I would prefer regeneration or whatever you want to call it to try to thin out these overgrown forests, open them up, get fire back in. You are disturbing it. Lots of invasive weeds like disturbed ground. They're going to come in, and we see that happening on sites. The good news is that with some reasonable treatment, it seems possible that the indigenous material will recover, that the weeds will be there for a period of years, and then they will gradually be choked out as you begin restoring or resuscitating the native stuff. But there are going to be places where the weed situation, the cheatgrass, for example, in the Great Basin is so intense that it's very hard to see how you're going to reintroduce fire on anything like its historic level or its value until you do something about the weeds. Again, you have to create the environment for fire. Just putting fire in, it's not some kind of ecological pixie dust. You sprinkle it over the landscape and it makes it all good and beautiful. It's just going to act on whatever is there. And if you've got weeds, you're liable to get more weeds. So you have to create the conditions for fire to work. But in general, it's a serious problem. But it's already a serious problem, and leaving, you know, and ignoring it doesn't make it go away either. Now, the other issue on the Aborigines of Australia is a very is a fascinating one. In fact, I wrote a book about Australia called Burning Bush, which has a large section, reviews the Aboriginal story. And the evidence is, I think, compelling, and it seems to be growing, that Aborigines were very effective at very large-scale continental changes of biota by burning. And I suspect by a combination of hunting and burning, killing off large megafauna, all of which essentially disappear at the time of human entry. And part of it here, I think, is that you have the conditions over much of Australia, not all of it, but most of it, in one way or another, the wetting and drying. So the northern third is in the tropical wet-dry monsoon. The southeast, southwest are in Mediterranean climates. Other areas are prone to longer cycles of drought, the whole ENSO phenomenon. So you've got the conditions, but you did not have regular ignition until people arrived. And so people, I think, were with fairly simple technologies, were very powerful and were able to make a huge difference. And they burned. Like, I can't think of any people coming in, first colonizing, first contact story that does not involve fire, which is not marked by charcoal, but some areas, they're not very effective until they also have agriculture. So, in other words, they can create the fuel. It's not just control over the ignition, but control over the fuel. I think in Australia, because of the climatic conditions, you had the fuel available, but you lacked spark, and people came in and did it, and we've seen enormous changes as a result of eliminating Aboriginal burning. And since they've been there for 50 or 60,000 years, one has to wonder what natural means, what natural fire means in those contexts.
We have other callers. We'll try to get at least one more in Champaign next, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Very interesting. I grew up in Australia, adjacent to a large mountain that was regularly on fire. The trees would come crashing down like rockets and things like that. I was also subject to flooding. The community would be cut off by floods very regularly. I wanted to say that the white population does do what you're talking about. They do often encourage certain grasses. The hill that we were on was regularly burned by a guy that kept his cows on the commons, and that was the hill. But very shortly, that hill had lost its native nature, except for a thing called blady grass, which is very flammable. But what an effect it does by firing too often is to reduce the more elegant and often more nutritious plants that are there, and that was fairly damning. Locally, I would say that sometimes you do have to harvest fairly heavy lumber. Here we have maples that are subject to fire. If you don't burn them for 150 years, they become your forest with chinkapin oak and all sorts of other things. An understory becomes a maple forest. And then you have to really consider, like the Illinois Nature Preserve Commission has been giving permission to people to remove, to log out the maple population. And how do you do it? You can't clear cut. You have to go in there. Do you do it with a bulldozer? Do you do it with oxen or whatever? But it is happening, and the target is the older population of trees. I would want to say something about the roadsides. The transportation department has a thing about switchgrass in this area, and they plant it in a very dominating manner. And when legitimate fires are created to control burn or those areas, the dominance of cultivar variety native switchgrass can cause a real fire hazard. Instance just south on 45, south of Champaign recently, there's a mile of very, very dense switchgrass, and that creates a problem with traffic, burning, and the thermals that take unburned material up and into different places with different wind directions. So I just made those comments because I was very interested in what you were saying, and I don't know whether you have any comments to make.
Well, Professor Pine, you wanted to respond to any of the points that caller raised?
Oh, gosh, there are lots of things to respond to. I guess the simplest thing to say is to repeat that we constantly get into trouble by making large general pronouncements about fire. It's good or bad. The issue is only makes sense in a practical way on a site-by-site basis. And the issue is also not whether you have fire or not, but what kind of fire you have, what the regime of fire will be. And the sooner you can introduce a few levels of distinction, a little bit of nuance into the discussion, you get much further along.
We want to get one more caller here on campus, line one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for speaking to our audience here. I wanted to make a pitch if I tuned in late. Perhaps you've already done this, but I wanted to make a pitch for putting this in a biodiversity context in fire-prone regions such as the Midwest. In the absence of fire in our oak woodlands, in time with the closure of the canopy, great majority of the diversity of the plant species in any particular community type are shaded out, and because of fragmentation, we don't have opportunities for immigration of shade-tolerant species to compensate for the loss of species. So it's another perspective to put it in a biodiversity issue. There's a this is where most of the diversity is in the ground cover and the changes that are going on. There's a great cost to it in terms of floristic diversity. Just that I'd add that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Professor Pine, you want to comment on that at
all?
Well,
no, that's an important point, because often fire is condemned as a threat to biodiversity, and what people do is look at some area of tropical forest that's been essentially leveled and napalmed and, of course, destroyed. But again, the question is, what is the actual regimen of fire on the site? And in most areas, fire actually promotes biodiversity done right. It's a great catalyst. It's a great jolt of energy. And many areas really require it. They need some exposure to sunlight. They need a little stirring. It's a difference between having a stew over a slow fire and boiling a little bit, staying warm, and just leaving, turning off the fire and leaving it into a cold sludge. The fire can be very useful, but it has to be a certain kind of fire, and it has to be able to perform as that kind of fire. So you have to do things. And the Midwest is very interesting because it shows, again, I think, the role of people in shaping these grasslands. Because you don't have a powerful dry lightning fire regime, it seems pretty clear that long burning by people was responsible for creating a lot of the biodiversity. So that doesn't mean, if you burn, you get biodiversity. No, again, site by site, what kind of fire in what kind of setting. But these categorical denunciations of fire as a destroyer of biodiversity are nonsense. Far more species are threatened by the elimination of fire than by its perpetuation in the right form.
We're going to have to stop there because we're at the end of the time. We want to say, Professor Pine, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Stephen Pine, he's professor of history at Arizona State University. If you would like to read the book we've been talking about, it's titled Year of the Fires, The Story of the Great Fires of 1910, and it is published by Viking.